Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Once again from London, England, because I haven't moved it yet. Ladies and gentlemen, this did not happen to me, but it happened to a member of my family. And it happened last weekend, but I desisted from telling you about it last weekend because I wanted to make sure that she actually got back home safely. Because if I'd blown the whistle on this airline back then, they might have, you know, decided they'd never fly. Well, she never actually didn't end up flying on this airline. So, but she was flying from Los Angeles to London on Air New Zealand. I'm going to name them too. And then was going to connect to a flight from London to Dublin on an airline here in the UK called BMI, the former British Midland. But now, you know, it's BMI. It's got to be better. Well, it was cold and snowy last weekend in London, as it has been for a while. And so it was a bit questionable whether the flight was good. It came in fine. And then the question was, well, would the connecting flight be happening? And there was some mystery. You know, people in airports love mystery. And finally, she was told, well, Dublin Airport is closed, so we can't fly there, said the nice folks at BMI. Her baggage was not available through. And, of course, you have to go through customs here. You've come from the United States. That's a dangerous place. So where were her bags? Well, Air New Zealand didn't know where they were. And BMI didn't know where they were. And as she's waiting around to try to find her bags, and it's not just her, everybody else in the same position, they're hearing the public address announcements for flights to Dublin on other airlines. And some of them who don't have checked baggage just rush off to get on those other flights because they can get to Dublin. But these people are stuck because they can't leave their bags behind and nobody knows where they are. So they can't get to Dublin. So she spends about 4 hours doing that and finally decides to join my wife and me in central London. Because, you know, camping out at Heathrow, the first 4 hours is great. It slopes downward from there. About an hour later, we have the woman from BMI on the phone, the lovely Pam. And she says, well, you know, we can't. We found the bags. Great. Can you send them to where we are now in London? No, we can't do that. It's against policy. Really? What's the policy? Well, she didn't fly with us. She didn't fly with you because you canceled the flight. But that's our policy. We can't send baggage to people who haven't flown with us. All right, where's your supervisor? Well, he's not around at the moment. Really? So you're the supervisor, de facto, right? Well, yeah, I'm the only one here. So you could countermand your policy. You're the... No, and it goes from there. Long story short, no, we could not. They would not send her bags to where she was staying in London, trying to recover from the fine afternoon at Heathrow. So we had to send somebody to go get them. And, you know, it was. I have to say, I'm making it sound much more good humored than it actually was in the experience. It was fraught. So, ladies and gentlemen, be like my relative, my best word of advice. Next time you want to fly to Dublin, don't fly BMI. Fly ASCAP. Now, the quote of the week comes from the New York Times. And it tells you this guy just isn't getting paid enough money. Now, of course, none of us are getting paid enough money. Neither Dave nor Conan nor Jane nor me. But this guy, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, a gentleman by the name of Jamie Dimon, who said at the hearing where a bunch of bankers were hauled before Congress, oh, they must have been scared pitless by that. Oh, that Congress is going to crack down. Anyway, Jamie Dimon at one point in the hearing said this, as quoted in the New York Times. Somehow, we just missed, you know, that home prices don't go up forever. Pay that man just cut the check for another $60 million for him right now, please. Would you do that? The buried lead of the week comes from the New York Times as well. It's a story about President Hamid Karzai really asserting control, getting the government together in Afghanistan. The parliament has rejected for the second consecutive time many of his nominees for his cabinet. So that was the lead. But here's way, way down, miner's helmet down, is this. One position that was filled, that is to say that Parliament did approve, was that of the Minister for Counter-Narcotics, a powerful post given the importance of Afghanistan in the global drug trade. The new minister is Zarar Ahmad Mokbel, former Interior Minister, who was forced out of office in 2008 amid allegations of corruption. He's good enough. They like him. Parliament thought he was good enough to approve. And speaking of which, in the new Iraq, leading Sunni politicians now warn that Iraq is sliding towards a dark unknown. In the wake of the decision to ban more than 400 Sunni candidates from competing in the upcoming general election. That move is increasingly being seen as a test of the election's legitimacy and a direct threat to the Shia-led government's attempts at reconciling the country. The country's Electoral Commission banned 500 candidates from running in the March 7th election. More than 80% were Sunni nominees who'd been counted on and courted to take part to prevent a rerun of the 2005 election, which saw a Sunni boycott and a slide towards sectarian violence. So, rerun, maybe we need a resurge. Reconciliation has always been a farce, says Saleh al-Mutlaq, who's the head of the National Dialogue Front. Would like to join that. That sounds like a good organization. He's appealing against the decision. This government cannot be nationalist. They are made up of members who've been brought up to be sectarian from childhood. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. Let's surge again like we did last summer. Hello, welcome to the show.
Bad love.
from the edge of the Thames River in London, England, actually from Leicester Square. I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome. The original Leicester Square. I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of Le Show. And I've never done this before, so I'm going to do this now for the first time. There was an entertainment feature segment that was supposed to be on today's broadcast and is not going to be. And that's all my own fault. But I'm going to make it up to you. Because in a few hours, there will be a little notice on Twitter from at LitTwits, which is me, giving you a way to access it via the internet. And all I'll say, it's a phone conversation between the devil and Pat Robertson. You should have heard it on the radio, but you can still hear it on the internet. And check at LitTwits in a few hours, won't you? Because I got to go have dinner. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you can just imagine the amount of profanities I uttered when I discovered that had happened. But anyway, you know, it's the computer age. We have a solution. The news of Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, coming your way now, this very moment, right here, right now. First of all, they're both from AFPAC, actually Afghanistan. The U.S. has spent $732 million. That's almost three-quarters of a billion since 2002, to more than double Afghanistan's energy capacity. That's good on us. Good for us. But 85% of urban households remain without electricity. Well, that's bad for us. That's according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, retired General Arnold Fields. He says results have been disappointing, and the current projects face delays and rising costs because of deteriorating security and poor oversight by U.S. government agencies. Now, they have plenty of oversight. They've overlooked everything. The report also said the Afghan government lacks a clear plan for how to continue developing its energy sector and that it's unable to connect enough utility fees from users to maintain the infrastructure that's been built so far. They could take a tip from a couple of companies you and I know there, couldn't we? Couldn't they? Afghanistan's energy capacity has multiplied, more than doubled. Still, Afghans continue to suffer severe shortages, forcing most people to rely on costly generators. It's been a long time since we've heard how the electricity that we restored in Iraq is going. This sounds so much like that, doesn't it? Only about 15% of urban households had access to electricity, 6% in rural areas. And about three-fourths of the ongoing corruption investigations led by U.S. oversight officials, you remember them, we mentioned them earlier, in Afghanistan, are targeting suspects who aren't Afghans. That also according to the Special Inspector General. He wouldn't identify officials or companies under investigation. The figures seem to support Afghan government contentions that corruption is as widespread among Western officials as it is in their own ranks. Yeah, but our guys aren't dealing opium, okay? About 40% of our investigations involve procurement fraud, said the Assistant Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. Western governments frequently issue large contracts to support military and reconstruction efforts, the Assistant Inspector General Ray DeNunzio, formerly of the FBI, promised. We have remedies to recover U.S. taxpayer mummies. So, good people doing good things in Afghanistan, ladies and gentlemen. And speaking of AFPAC, let's hear something about the Pakistan side of AFPAC, won't you? Pakistan is likely to become a more Islamist state and increasingly anti-American in the coming years. All right, then. Let's pour some money down that particular orifice, complicating U.S. efforts to win its support against Islamist militants. This is according to a report released here in London this week. It looks at Pakistan over a 1 to 3 year time horizon. Well, if you're going to look long term like that, of course things are going to look bad. Concentrate on the next couple months, babe. The report rules out the possibility of a Taliban takeover or of it becoming the world's first nuclear-armed failed state. Okay, fine. Out the door, Josephine. Rather than an Islamist takeover, you should look at a subtle power shift from a secular pro-Western society to an Islamist anti-American one. That doesn't seem so subtle to me, but this is the words of Jonathan Paris, who produced the report for the Legatum Institute, a London think tank. He forecasts Pakistan is likely to muddle through. Speculation of a Taliban takeover dramatically overestimates the willingness of the political and military elites to surrender power to the Taliban. Or anybody. U.S. and British leverage over Pakistan is not growing, it is decreasing. Pakistani society is moving towards anti-Americanism and toward more Sharia law. Hey, let's go to Pakistan and see some burqas. What do you say? The rising influence of Islamist political parties and of militant groups in its Punjab province will slowly transform Pakistan by exploiting local grievances over the economy and the slow and often corrupt legal system. Islamist political parties thriving on anti-American rhetoric would not become dominant, but would raise pressure on the government to reject public cooperation with Washington. So that's what it looks like coming up for Afghanistan. If this guy knows what he's talking about, who knows? Never heard of him before. But, you know, just something to alarm all of us. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. First from the Telegraph here in London, the FBI has admitted using a photograph of a bearded Spanish politician as the basis for a mocked-up photo image that shows how Osama bin Laden might look now. The State Department was forced to withdraw the mocked-up image circulated around the world last week after the discovery was not quite as technically sophisticated as the FBI originally claimed. It's a digitally altered image of an older and graying bin Laden. It was meant to show how he might look without his trademark turban and beard. It was released in a renewed effort to locate him. But it created an unexpected stir in Madrid when a Spanish member of parliament recognized strong elements of himself, of his own bad self in the image, and complained to the United States. The FBI claimed to have used cutting-edge technology. These are the people. Wasn't the FBI the people who tried for 4 years to update their computer system and failed? Okay, so they claimed to use cutting-edge technology to reproduce new images of 18 of the world's most wanted terrorist suspects for the State Department. But now a spokesman for the FBI admitted that a technician was not satisfied with the hair features offered by the FBI software program. Bad hair day at the FBI. Bad hair feature day at the FBI. And instead used part of a photo of Gaspar Llamazares, found right there on the internet. The technician had no idea whose image he'd found. Mr. Llamazares said the mistake showed the low level of U.S. intelligence services. He's bitter. He's just bitter. From the Times of London, the president of Mongolia has called a moratorium on the death penalty. He says, quote, "The majority of the world's countries have chosen to abolish the death penalty. We should follow this path. The president said he would start at once. From tomorrow, I'll pardon those on death row." The number of executions in Mongolia, a country the size of Western Europe with a population of only 3 million, is a state secret. It's not clear how many people the country has executed. Amnesty International, Mongolia, says at least 5 were executed in 2008. So it's now it's just the United States and China, I think. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, not Mongolia. They have no death row anymore. From the Times of London as well, the architects of the military mission in Afghanistan face a finely balanced set of problems as they try to build up Afghan forces to 400,000 by the end of next year from the current 96,000. The problem so far, according to the American commander of the training mission, Lieutenant General Bill Caldwell, is the mission has been under-resourced in Western trainers. And has meant sacrificing quality for quantity on the basis that quantity has a quality all its own. Only 15% of Afghan soldiers have any ability to read. So that's heavy training. The American commander claims that the situation is changing. About 850 U.S. trainers will arrive this month. And Afghan army and police are being paid a decent wage. Army reenlistment rates are now 75%. Desertion rates have dropped from 45 to 7%. Still, the ethnic makeup of Afghanistan is complex, and although the army is balanced carefully to include appropriate representation of all ethnicities, the representation of Pashtuns, the dominant ethnicity that lives in the insurgent areas, is skewed. Only 3 to 5% of the army comes from the southern areas of the country. The Pashtuns in the army are overwhelmingly eastern and consequently speak a different language than the one spoken in the south. That makes the army outsiders in the south. Uh-oh, problem, according to the Times of London. From the Independent, now this, ladies and gentlemen, is your brain getting off the war on drugs. And I don't know if you've seen or heard hide or hair of this anywhere else, but this came as news to me in The Independent. After 40 years of defeat and failure, they write, America's war on drugs is being buried in the same fashion it was born, amid bloodshed, confusion, corruption, and scandal. U.S. agents are being pulled away from South America. Washington is putting its narcotics policy under review. And South America is no longer prepared to go along. Indeed, after the expenditure of billions of dollars and the violent deaths of tens of thousands of people, a suitable epitaph for America's longest war, in quotes, may well be the plan now being hatched in Bolivia for every family to be given the right to grow coca in its own backyard. Babe! The war, declared by Richard Nixon in 1969, is expiring as its strategists start discarding plans that have proved futile over four decades. They're preparing to withdraw agents from narcotics battlefields from Colombia to Afghanistan and beginning to coach them in the art of trumpeting victory and melting away into anonymous defeat. We'll see. We'll see about that. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, outside the bubble, from the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, a floor collapsed beneath a group of about 20 members of Weight Watchers as they gathered to compare how many pounds they had lost over Christmas. Members of the Weight Loss Club were lining up to compare readings on the scales when they heard a bang as the floor came away from the walls of their meeting room in southern Sweden. We're going to have to find replacement premises, said a consultant for Weight Watchers. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
The press, they wouldn't print it if it wasn't true. If you want to know about the gay politician, yeah. If you want to know how to drive your car, if you want to know about the new sex position, you can read it in the Sunday papers.
And it's not just the and it's not just the Mongolians that are ahead of us, ladies and gentlemen. If you think that's ahead, the Afghans, even though you know they don't have a government or anything, are now going to allow detainees at our other secret prison. You know about our other secret prison? Maybe you don't. It's a secret. It's at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. It's our base. It's where the NFL pregame show on Fox originated in a big let's support the troops stunt earlier, I think in October. Bagram. It's the place where the only U.S. secret prison where, as far as we know, detainees of ours have lost their little lives. So they will now be allowed to challenge, and the detainees at Bagram have not been covered by the Supreme Court decision that gave habeas corpus rights to our detainees at Guantanamo. Just a nutty thing the Supreme Court did. You get habeas corpus, you don't. So now the Afghanistan government will allow the detainees to challenge their detention when Afghanistan takes over the jail. That'll be a while. But they've announced it. They have to still train hundreds of their troops as prison wardens. And as we pointed out earlier, they can't read. No date has been set for the handover, but it's been agreed to. And once the prison is under Afghan control, inmates will be able to challenge their detention through the Afghan courts. Now, if the Afghan courts allowed television, then we got a deal. Now we got something. Now we got entertainment for the whole family. But anyway, but until then, you know, they can just sit there. The facilities have been improved, so I guess if they're waterboarded, they're using spring water now. It's been new. It's new and improved in Bagram. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. NBC, which will be broadcasting the Vancouver Winter Olympics, now says it expects to lose money on the Games. The first time the Olympics has been a money loser in the network's history. This came from Dick Ebersol, the chairman of NBC Universal Sports, and the executive producer of the network's Olympic broadcasts. He said sales of advertising for the Olympics had picked up recently after lagging far below forecast through the summer and fall, which he attributed to the economic slump and to the fact that advertisers didn't listen to his advice about how to appeal to the rest of the country, just like Conan O'Brien didn't. But advertising revenue will not be enough to overcome the sharp increases in license fees that NBC has agreed to pay to broadcast the Olympics, he said. I believe that was an agreement he negotiated. While he, you know, in the time where he wasn't busy telling Conan O'Brien how to appeal to the middle of the country. NBC paid more than $2 billion for the domestic rights to broadcast the Summer and Winter Olympics in 2010 and 2012. More than one-third more than it paid for the previous Olympics. So these got to be better Olympics. They got to be a third better. The chairman and chief executive of GE, the parent of NBC, Jeffrey Immelt, told GE investors NBC is likely to lose a couple hundred million bucks on the Olympics this winter alone. But, you know, it's worth it for ice dancing, isn't it? Because, ladies and gentlemen, the Olympics, it's a movement, and we all need one. Every day. So please give, won't you? Now, in case you're not familiar with the references to Dick Ebersol advising Conan O'Brien in the very same press conference with the fine people of the television press, Dick Ebersol said that the whole controversy at NBC had come up because Conan O'Brien's hosting of The Tonight Show had been an astounding failure, his words, because Conan had not listened to Dick Ebersol when Dick told him in a meeting how to, you know, that he had to broaden his appeal and aim the show more at the central time zone. For references on Dick's comedy expertise, check the Eddie Murphy years of Saturday Night Live. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States, you know, stood up with the two most recent other presidents this weekend to announce something about Haiti. But there's other business going on at the White House this weekend. You know that predictions are that the Democrats may not win the race for the Senate seat that was vacated when Teddy Kennedy died, which would mean the Democrats lose their 60-vote majority, which would mean trouble for the health reform bill that is right now being negotiated between the House and the Senate. So the question is, how long will it take after the new senator from Massachusetts is elected before he or she is sworn in, and do the Democrats have the time to do something about the health care bill? So the president, unlike the rest of the health care bill drama that's been going on all the past year, where he sort of sat back and watched it and you know, hurled thunderbolts every once in a while. He's reportedly directly involved in the process at this stage of the game. And we will hear exactly how directly moments from now here on the show.
Last rays of sunlight died. Full moon begins to rise, reflected in your eyes. I can't believe this is happening. You make the motor in me flutter and wow.
struck five and ten. My happy tears were descending. I can't believe this is happening. You make the murder in me flutter and wild. Shout out loud, make me cry out day and night. My voice got stuck in my throat. Put my hand up into the sleeve of my coat, so you'd never know how it was shaking. I can't believe this is happening. You make the mortar in me flutter and wild. Shout out loud, make me cry out day and night. Make me cry all day and night.
Now, Desiree, let's only use the blue dishes tonight, okay?
Whatever you say, Michelle. We're still setting it for just you and the President and Senator Reid and Speaker Pelosi.
I think so. Unless some more dinner crashers have been invited.
Well, I think if word gets out about what Chef's preparing tonight, even the crashers would turn around and go home.
Really? I looked at the menu and I thought it was okay.
Confit a pigeon?
It is kind of fancy, isn't it?
Fancy? Michelle, pardon my French, but pigeons you can eat on the sidewalk. Maybe for people coming to this house, the least we can do is chicken.
Well, I'll have a word with Chef just as soon as...
Hey, honey. Everything ready for the big dinner?
Oh, of course. Desiree was just going to have a final word with the chef.
That's right, Mr. President. I am. I mean, I was. I mean, I will.
Don't worry, honey. This dinner will set exactly the right stage for your conversation with Reed and Pelosi.
Oh, it better. If we lose the Senate seat in Massachusetts, there goes all hope for the big health care deal. We need these folks to agree tonight so we can get that sucker passed right away.
Chef says it'll be confit of chicken.
Can they do that to a chicken?
Hey, wait a minute. You ladies talking about the dinner menu? Didn't anybody in the social office call down here?
Only to say that Salahi is spelled with one L.
Well, one of Speaker Pelosi's daughters convinced her to go vegetarian for her complexion. If she sees chicken on her plate, we can kiss the whole idea of a fast reconciliation process goodbye.
Oh, I'm sure a chef can think of something. After all, our state dinner for the Indian Prime Minister was all vegetarian. From our own garden.
Yeah, well, chef says he used all of our garden on that dinner. And half of the Safeway.
Well, we better...
Daddy, do we have to eat downstairs tonight?
Oh, big dinner tonight, Princess. Mm. Important folks coming over that your dad has to impress. So, yes, you and Kitten need to eat in the Jefferson room. But there's a big screen TV in there.
But no cable.
Well, I better see about something that doesn't have legs.
Besides, Daddy, when I looked on the schedule, I thought it said your big dinner was tomorrow night.
Oh, that can't possibly be true, honey. Desiree is on top of all this. She's had the kitchen on this case since, well, since this morning.
Wait a minute. It should be on my black... Holy carp. It is tomorrow night. Desiree got this all mixed up. Wow, that may be too late to save the bill. Healthcare will be deader than Nancy Pelosi's complexion.
But, Daddy, can't you just introduce the bill again, you know? Start over? You and Mommy always tell me to try again, not to give up.
She's right. We do.
I know we do, but this is different.
Everything's different.
No, Princess, this is an election year. We'll lose centrist votes in the Congress.
You might not if you made another primetime speech.
Honey, the networks are already angry about how much airtime we've asked for. If I'm lucky, they'll offer me the 10 o'clock slot on NBC.
So, maybe when my schoolwork gets too hard, I should just blame it on my social secretary.
No, sweetie. It's just that...
Well, I had to twist the chef's arm, but he saved the day.
Hmm?
He's going to do confit of tofu.
Oh, maybe it's better the dinner's not till tomorrow.
You think?
We don't have to eat that, do we?
No, Princess. We'll come eat with you girls and...
And we'll save the tofu for the Salahis.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Yes, I'm right here. Standing in front of his Ravenswood Manor home this week, former governor of Illinois Rod Blagojevich apologized for saying he was blacker than Barack Obama to Esquire magazine. We'll start with the race-related apologies. It'll take a while. What I said was stupid, 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 Blagojevich now says. What I said was a metaphor. Obviously, I'm not blacker than President Obama. It was a stupid way of saying something. I apologize for saying that in such a stupid way. It was a stupid metaphor expressing real frustration. I think he thinks he was stupid. Now, to Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele. He apologized for not letting top Republican officials know that he was writing a book called Right Now, a 12-Step Program for Defeating the Obama Agenda. I thought they'd been notified, Steele said. For that, I apologize. I was not trying to blindside anybody. He addressed questions over when he wrote the book. The book was written in 2008, he said, when interviewers have noted that the book is filled with references to events that occurred in 2009. Steele explained that after the book's original publication date was delayed, he updated it. He also encountered criticism after his, did Michael Steele, after his January 4th appearance on the Sean Hannity program for using the phrase "honest Injun" to punctuate a point he was making about conservative ideals. Several Native American leaders said the term is racist and said Steele should apologize. He didn't do so, and calls to the Republican committee for comment went unreturned on the matter. Then, of course, came the Harry Reid controversy, the quotes from Harry Reid to the authors of Game Change, where he referred to Obama as a light-skinned black person who didn't speak with a Negro dialect unless he wanted to. And Steele, the Republican chairman, called on Reid to step down. Reid apologized. Then Steele was confronted with his apparent hypocrisy. "Well, if honest Injun is a slur," he said, "I apologize for it. It's not an intent to be a racial slur. I wasn't intending to say a racial slur at all." End of race-related apologies. On to the others. A comic strip in the student newspaper at Notre Dame has started the new semester with a harsh lesson. A talking saw asks, "What's the easiest way to turn a fruit into a vegetable?" "No idea," a man responds. "A baseball bat," says the saw. It led to an outcry at how the strip plays on violence against gay people. The editor-in-chief of the paper says, "I was personally outraged and extremely offended that something of that nature had been printed in our paper. Our written apology is the first step in moving forward." The province of Manitoba has issued an apology to former residents of the Cathedral Valley Group Home. Some men who lived in the provincially run facility call themselves Lost Boys and say they're still affected by what happened to them. On behalf of the province of Manitoba, an apology is extended to those harmed by their residency at the home. The apology follows a review. Boys were placed there as an alternative to a detention facility. The review noted some students benefited from the facility while others were emotionally harmed by its militaristic style. Chile's president has apologized to the descendants of a group of indigenous people who were shipped to Europe in the late 19th century and exhibited. The remains of the Cahuéscar Indians from the country's southernmost region were honored in a ceremony after being flown back. Taken in 1881, they were displayed as curiosities in European cities. President Michel Bachelet said the government had been guilty of neglect in the face of such abuses. Israel apologized to Turkey this week for publicly dressing down Ankara's ambassador in a dispute that has strained the ties between the Jewish state and the Muslim regional power. Turkey had demanded a formal apology for the ambassador's treatment and threatened to recall him. But after receiving the letter of apology on Wednesday, the Turkish prime minister threw a new barb at Israel, saying it should do more for peace in the region. And President Mauricio Funes has apologized to the victims of El Salvador's brutal civil war and recognized the state's role in human rights violation. He also announced the creation of a commission to prepare moral and material reparations for abuses that committed during the 12-year war that pitted right-wing governments against Marxist guerrillas. Rapper Dappy of the British hip-hop group N-Dubs has publicly apologized after sending threatening text messages to a woman who criticized the band on a radio program. Canadian police officials have apologized to travelers after an officer allowed Halle Berry and her family to cut the line at Montreal Airport and check in ahead of their fellow flyers. 50 years after one of the worst disasters in medical history, hundreds of survivors of the thalidomide scandal got an apology from the British government and a new £20 million compensation package. Google has issued a public apology to Chinese writers and admitted it scanned books under Chinese copyright for its Google Books literary project. And the relicensing of Vermont Yankee nuclear plant appeared in doubt this week as lawmakers and members of the state government expressed outrage that officials from the nuclear power plant may have misled regulators. We'll have more on that next week, but the plant owners, Entergy, there's that name again, have apologized. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. There are reports now that Wall Street banks are going to put caps on cash bonuses and make cuts in the proportion of revenues paid out to employees in a rearguard action against the public and political reaction to their payouts and bonuses. And it just strikes me as they're backing down. That's the wrong way to do it. They should be speaking up for the bonus culture, or at least singing up for it.
sad, wicked traitor. Brains of a gamer, balls of a blader. Forbes called him a financial Darth Vader. Don't mean maybe, that was my baby. Credit default swaps, CDOs, what the hell they were, my baby knows. Sure they collapse, but his wealth grows. Avoiding the onus, just banking his bonus. He's my bonus baby.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet, on your computer at two different locations whenever you want it, live or archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone via Stitcher.com. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/the show. Say it with me. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And be just like you going to Twitter and finding the secret code for the devil calling Pat Buchanan, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And thanks to Adrian Bodenham, the Bod, here at Global Radio in London for helping with today's broadcast. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of music heard here on, available at the always-evolving harryshearer.com. It's the only kind of evolution we believe in around here. See you from New Orleans next week, where it's even warmer than London. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW of Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London.